trying to get away from the two-trial concept. I think it's from, you recall, your district court being made a court of record for that purpose. And luckily, this statute isn't used very often. I'm not sure how many people are even aware of it. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. It encourages would encourage two hearings. The public's time is taken up twice, I assume, on essentially the same issue. And it's also, I might point out, as far as the counties are concerned, in direct conflict to a statute that in Chapter 203, Chapter 203, ORS 203-200, which indicates the decisions of the county court made in the transactions of county business shall be reviewed only upon the writ of review provided by the Civil Procedure Statute, which is, of course, in Chapter 34. And that's, frankly, the easiest way for us to do our business is by way of writ of review on county matters, planning, zoning matters, and subdivision partitioning matters. The state of the law in writ of review matters now is such that the circuit court makes sure that the appropriate standards were applied, that there was reliable evidence at the board's decision-making hearing, and I think it protects the rights of the all sides more than adequately. I recommend that you pass this bill.
Representative Kielgowski?
I don't recall the recent Supreme Court case that dealt with writ of review. Will this bill affect that decision?
Let's see if I can remember which one you're talking about. There have been a lot of Supreme Court cases.
The latest one, what was it? Was it? What are you doing? Wint Mandamus?
Durker.
Is that what it was?
Cooks versus Durker. I think this would be consistent with that. As I recall, Brooks versus Durker, it was a 60-day, they applied the 60-day limitation on the declaratory judgment and essentially recommended strongly that a writ of review be the best way to handle planning and zoning matters. And thinking back on it, I think that this is consistent with the policies promoted by the court in that case.
Further questions?
I'm kind of trying to read this thing and the way it's worded with all the statutes, and I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to run them all down. Would you actually bring within the ambit of this statute as a writ of review all actions taken by governmental bodies?
Well, Chapter 92 just deals with subdivisions and partitions. So I guess, and I have to admit, that no one has ever brought a de novo appeal since I've been the lawyer for the Board of County Commissioners under this statute. We have a partitioning ordinance, we have a subdivision ordinance, and generally people, I think, have gone under Chapter 34 anyway. It's just, it's kind of an anomaly. It promotes two trials, and it's inconsistent with the other statute. And I think this would, as I take it, anything having to do with decision having to do with subdivision partition would go by way of writ of review. And I'll admit that's an overgeneralization, but from what I've seen of it, I think that's correct.
If this bill were passed.
If this was passed. If this particular statute were repealed.
Mr. Gardner?
What kind of, you mentioned the fact that you don't have any experience in Clackamas County with people availing themselves of the de novo review in circuit court. Is that correct?
On this section, let me backtrack a little bit and say that there have been people filing declaratory judgment or mandamus or something like this on planning and zoning matters, and perhaps some of those were subdivision partitioning matters. I can think of some partitioning matters that did come up under this. Our ordinance, I'm not sure that our ordinance says we go by way of writ of review or not, but it's not, I've never heard anybody cite specifically this section as their authority for filing declaratory judgment in the court. That's not to say that they haven't, but in
I'm a little confused, if I might, Mr. Chairman. Chapter 92 deals with subdivisions and partitions. This would make the exclusive remedy for review, a writ of review. Is that correct? Okay. The question I have is, are people using the de novo appeal to circuit court in lieu of the writ of review, which they could use at this time?
Not in Clackamas County.
Okay. How about generally through the state?
I'm not able to speak to that.
So in essence, you're here today because you're afraid that at some point in time someone might use it or might cause there to be two hearings.
Yeah. I think that the whole direction of the law is against the pretrial concept, and this is a kind of a mastodon sitting there that I think should be put to rest.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
House Bill 2406. Craig Chisholm.
I'm Craig Chisholm. I work as an associate counsel for Pioneer National Title Insurance Company, and I'm here to testify against this bill, basically because it destroys the effectiveness of the notarization as a way of avoiding fraud and some other problems. Notary seals and that function is a very old function, goes back to the time of the Norman Conquest. The Oregon Supreme Court has, in at least one case, spoken on the subject of notaries. This was in 1967 in the case of Walder at 247 Oregon 13. And there the court said, when a notary officially certifies that the grantor of a deed has personally appeared before the notary and acknowledged that the deed has been voluntarily and knowingly executed, it must be a meaningful certification. It is possible that the deed in question in this case would not have been executed if the proper notarial procedure had been followed. The statute, that's ORS 194 and so on, make careful and detailed provisions to safeguard the notarial function and to give all the assurance that law can give that the notary's function will be properly performed. The validity of a real estate transaction is frequently dependent on the notary's performance of duty. We in the title of business, at least speaking for Pioneer National Title, agree with it, that the notarial function as it now is discourages forgeries, false impersonations, signatures by incapacitated persons, and generally, and I think this is most important, it impresses upon persons involved in real property transactions that it's a matter of some gravity. Real property is oftentimes the most important asset that the broad range of people in society have, and it's essential that there is some second person taking some sort of look at it. Let me give you a few examples briefly. In one case, a person had the same name as his father. He was living in his father's house while the father was on vacation. The son took this opportunity to place a mortgage on the house. When the father returned home, he was faced with a mortgage foreclosure action, and the matter was quickly resolved, however, because the notary could be called in, and the notary immediately recognized that the man that had signed was a different man than the father, and as a result, the case was easily resolved. Without a notarial function, assuming the son had gone out of the jurisdiction, it might have resulted in a trial of some form to try to determine who actually did sign the document. You can think of other examples, for example, where people are mentally incapacitated or they're minors. There, this incapacity would be obvious to a notary because the person would have to come before him and sign. It would be, I believe, considerably easier to get some registered voter from the whole range of registered voters to perform this function for a conspirator than it would be to get a notary public. A notary public is bonded, he has a reputation in the community to uphold, all of these things that would militate against it. it a notarial function as it is now doesn't solve all the problems of fraud or incapacity, but locking your car door doesn't solve all the problems of theft. But people in both instances, I think, should follow those precautions.
Attorney Gardner?
Are you a notary?
Yes, I'm a notary.
How did you become one?
Sent in for it. Had to fill out some forms. get a $500 bond, which is a nominal bond. I am, though, set apart from just a voter in that in doing this, I had to have someone with real property sign for me, in my case.
Is there anything other than the $500 bond that you have that, say, a registered voter would not have as far as qualifications to perform any of those functions that you discussed?
Probably not too much, but by performing those functions, there is a record of who I am, where I am. There's something written down. I can be found again.
Couldn't you also be found if you were a legally registered voter?
Might be very difficult, especially if there's no real property connected with it. No bonding company, no real property. It's the sort of thing I might become a registered voter quite easily. A renter disappear the next day, and I couldn't be found again.
There isn't normally a corporate surety bond involved in a notarial commission, is there?
There may be. I believe an alternative.
Surety?
Pardon me?
Isn't it usually a personal surety?
It can be a personal surety, and I believe it can be also corporate surety, both ways.
Are there, in fact, corporate surety bonds on notaries public in Oregon?
Yes, I believe there are. They're not very expensive. They're quite inexpensive. But it is a step you have to go through. A bonding company is taking a slight look at you.
Well, my question is not whether there are bonding companies that would issue such bonds, but there are notaries who are satisfying the requirements, surety requirements, with a bond of that kind rather than personal sureties,
yeah,
with property of X dollars.
Yes, I believe so.
Representative Lombard?
Well, I had two questions, and I was just trying quickly here to determine one of them. It seems to me when we do apply for a notarial commission that we sign an oath of some sort too, don't we?
Yes, that's correct.
I believe that there is that kind of a step that distinguishes you from, you know, from an ordinary registered voter.
What does the oath say?
False notarization crime?
False notarization.
I believe it is, yes. Well, that's what I was trying to find out just quickly here in the statute, if I could see with regards to what the oath requires. I don't spot it right offhand. The very practical question I have, though, is this. So what do you do in terms of other states, where other states require that a signature be notarized on a deed or an instrument, and we have a provision like this? I'm wondering if we wouldn't have a problem with other states, giving full faith and credit, or however you want to put it, to our notaries if we relax the situation or if we took this approach.
I have not researched that, but I can certainly see that there might be some problems with that. A careful banking institution might not want to loan funds, for example, into the state. I don't know. That might be best to check with the banking people on that. Sometimes in dealing with foreign countries, they've been very sticky. For example, in South America, they're quite sticky about notarizations and certifications of the authority for the notary and this sort of thing. That could cause some delay with Oregon businesses dealing with foreign countries. Bills of lading oftentimes require notarizations. I don't know how it would carry over into different states if it's authorized by state law to have all registered voters notary public. I can see that might be a problem.
Further questions?
You cited the case where a notary was called to identify an individual who had previously sworn before him and thereby obviated the possibility in the way of a court case. Would that identification not have been equally possible by any individual who accomplished swearing capability under this act?
If the person were there, the person were reachable, but going further in the hypothetical, I am assuming that a notary is the sort of individual who will more likely be present in the community at a later date than just a random voter. There is, of course, to a degree, there's some security in just having a registered voter doing it. But I'm saying there's not as much security as having a notary, because there is an oath, there is some financial stake in it, there is some registration of some form. All of these things take place. There's a degree of formality, and I think that formality is important.
Question I have, do you intend to comment on 2509 and remove the requirement that a notary, I don't know if this is appropriate, Mr. Chairman, but it's another bill we have set up for hearing today, and it involves notaries. Remove the requirement we have to do with
I haven't really examined that bill very carefully at all. But if there are the procedures involved that we have already, such as the bonding requirement, I think that may get around some of the problems connected with other than U.S.
That other bill that bothers you quite a bit.
I haven't really examined it. This one bothers me particularly because it broadens out the whole function entirely.
It does away with it.
In essence, it does away with it.
Representative Gardner.
Not to belabor the bill that we're going to have a hearing on, but one of the main points you've made is that the notary is more likely to be in the community. Wouldn't that be obviated by having someone who is not a citizen, who might in fact be an alien, performing these functions?
Well, I haven't really studied that bill, but at least they are going through some form of bonding procedure. At least there is somebody in the community either bonding them or vouching for them because of real property. I think those are important, and there is still the formality of the procedure.
If the committee would look at House Bill 2406 in your book, there's a letter from Mr. Hinkle of the ACLU in front of that, and also we attached a copy of the stipulation and consent order signed by Mr. Leahy and the Attorney General before Judge Al Sokol of the federal court, in which Jeff Scopo appeared to me that said that it's unconstitutional to have the requirement that the person be a United States citizen. So that's going to be eliminated from that section.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the issue of whether he's a citizen or not, and yes, citizen seems to be moot.
Okay. Are there any further questions on this particular bill, 2406? Okay. Thank you. Let's take 2509 in tandem. Oh, I'm sorry, John, excuse me.
That was a long drive.
John, how are you? Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Holmes. I'm a practicing attorney in Portland, 630 Morgan Building. I practice law with the firm of Jensen, Frank, Holmes, and Shelding. I'm glad that I could testify because I did make the drive specifically to do so. I'd like to thank the chairman for allowing me to do that. I too would like to testify in opposition to HB 2406. There was a similar bill that was introduced last year that I also appeared in opposition to that was tabled, and I frankly think that this is worse than the last one. I must say that there is a certain amount, if you don't stop and think about it, there is a certain amount of jokes that are made about the notarial function, notary, sojack, etc., and at times I suppose I, along with everyone else, have thought that it is a useless or an annoying thing. But there are several ways that it operates in the state of Oregon in a convenient, inexpensive, and efficient way that performs a very useful service to all of the citizens of this state, and I think that the laws that we now have are adequate. Ironically, I might point out that the trend nationally is in the other direction, and there is a Yale Legislative Services work that I do not have, but I have an article by Dennis Arnold in 75, who was the chairman of the Yale Legislative Services group, that did some work in the drafting of the Uniform Notary Act, which I have not seen, but essentially from what I read, it provides a strengthening of protection against fraud for the location, the ready location of witnesses to signatures, the authentication of documents, etc. And the some of the arguments that came up last year was, well, why do you need it? For example, we don't have it in the transfer of title to automobiles. And I guess last year, since my primary area, probably two, trial law and real estate law, last year at that time I was involved in a fraud claim in federal court, $400,000 fraud loss, two things, check kiting and a float on used car lots, because one of the easiest methods of fraud, and it goes on a lot, is the transferring of titles by fraudulent signatures, because there is no witnessing requirements and there is no way to check the authenticity of the signatures. We found that one car, or one vehicle, I think it was a pickup, in this particular case, had been floored 67 times. Been floored 67 times, and there were a set of check kiting that ended up in a $400,000 loss. So, for some of those reasons, I would ask that you take a look at this and think about what we have. The laws, we have a $500 penal bond. We have a system of registration of the commission and with the Secretary of State's office. Most notaries in the state of Oregon use one of these embossing presses, which puts what they call an immutable or unchangeable or invariable stamp that is readable. One of the real problems that I have with any document that you look at, whether it's a real estate deed or whether it's your doctor's prescription, is reading it. Now, there is nothing about the protection of legibility in this proposed bill or the last one. Now, because we have a seal that is readable, a Secretary of State's office to go to, we have a simple system. Well, then you get to the cost or the nuisance of it. I don't think it's a nuisance to the Secretary of State's office. I think, frankly, that the Secretary of State's office will oppose this bill as I am. I don't think there is that much time involved, but because you have the seal, you have a check and an easy, convenient way of finding the witness to the signature or someone who authenticated the document. The demands for international trade and for other states, interstate trade, are immense. I believe Howard Traver testified last year that with regard to the Port of Portland, that the agencies involved in international trade, I believe there was one company that had requirements to have 14 notaries because they wanted that type of proof on the signatures used in international trade. There are requirements, as commented, in every other state and in just about every other nation. You're dealing with not only legibility, but you're dealing with missing witnesses, the forgery or fraud problems, alteration, destruction or partial destruction, and the need for security and safety in all of these areas. Now, if you just take a little look at this, there are a couple other problems, like what is this class, legally registered voter, and then down in the bottom it says resident. Well, there's another problem with locations of lists. How do you know whether you're a legally registered voter or not? I know a lot of people who have ended up not knowing whether they could vote in one place or another and ended up trying to be honest, going to their old place. I suppose a lot of people could go to two places. I suppose there's the voter card thing, but that's another problem. You also get into an area, as you know, that is changing. drastically changing, so you increase the numbers. You have no bond, you have no seal, and you really don't, if you look at what is required in Section 2.1a, the statement is about twice as long and cumbersome. The statement, the document was attested to before a legally registered voter of the state of Oregon who possesses the power to perform all functions associated with the office of notary public pursuant to the laws of the state of Oregon. Well, it's just about as easy just to take and put that seal on, and it's twice as readable, and you have twice the protection. Then you look at Section 3, and you get into where a document or signature is asserted to be authentic by a notary public, which is a simple thing. They now say that that should be satisfied by the way that we witness wills. Well, think about how we witness wills. Two witnesses, each in the presence of each other and in the presence of the testator. And now, as an added protection, so we make sure we know where the witnesses are, I think most law offices at that time have the witnesses signed before a notary that they were there in the presence of each other on such and such a day. So I guess what I'm saying is, all in all, that it seems to go the wrong direction. It's a poor bill. We have a good system, an inexpensive system, and one that works. Thank you.
Question? I think Mr. McMurdo is here. John, despite having to buy, you're glad you're here.
Thank you.
McMurdo, were you here on this bill and
I'm here on both. How's that?
And the companion?
I'll go.
I appreciate the committee's indulgence. I got scheduled with four bills all at about the same time in different committees. Here's some handouts The other committee was a subcommittee of one, the committee member being Senator Smith and the chairman being Senator Smith. So yeah. I felt that I should be there at 1 o'clock. If it's all right, and I'm moving off your agenda, but they are tied in, I'll comment on 2509, which repeals the citizenship requirement. And this simply amends ORS 194.010 to delete that requirement that a notary be a U.S. citizen. The reason for the introduction is the Federal District Court's decree or decision in Schaff, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, versus Robert W. Straub and Clay Myers. And I've included the judgment, a copy of the stipulation, the correspondence between Mr. Leahy of the Attorney General's office and our office. Basically, the court held unconstitutional and null and void that portion that purports to require citizenship to hold the office of notary. The basis was that the requirement denied resident aliens equal protection of the laws. And in Mr. Leahy's stipulation, you'll find probably the most recent of a whole series of cases dealing with the equal protection clause as it relates to resident aliens. One thing I would request, and it's an oversight on my part, is that an emergency clause be attached to this. It's not on there now, and if this committee could do that, it would be helpful to us. Our present application still requires someone to subscribe under oath that they are a citizen. We're sending those out because I don't want to waste the money. If someone objects, we can scratch it out. And if the bill passes, we will delete it on all of them. With respect to 26 or 2406, I've missed most of the testimony. I might add one thing. The last witness was talking about difficulties with international agreements. It was just this week that, were there any questions on the other bill? I had a couple in that were refugees from Hungary. They left shortly after the revolution, quote revolution, in 1956 and left their son, who was seven at that time. And they still own property in Hungary, which they would like to transfer, and I could not tell whether or not they were given a deed or a power of attorney. It was in Hungarian and in that very special type. It was a very beautiful thing to look at. The instructions they had from the ambassador, the Hungarian ambassador, were amazing to me. It required, first of all, that it be notarized. Second, that the county legalize the document. And the county merely certified that the notary had registered as a notary in the county. The other requirement was the Department of State in the state in which you reside legalized the document. All we could do would be that I could figure out was go to our files and determine this person on a certain date was a notary, commissioned by the governor, attested to by the Secretary of State. Under this type of bill, we couldn't possibly do that. This is superfluous, but the thing that I really feel sorry for these people about is they have to then go to the U.S. Department of State and have it, quote, legalized, whatever that means.
Oregon to be in 59.
Yes. With respect to the bill, this may have been raised. I just raised one comment. As I understand the bill, any registered voter is deemed to be a notary. And I think conversely that to be a notary, you have to be a registered voter. To be a registered voter under the Constitution and statutes of this state, you must be a U.S. citizen. And I'm wondering if we aren't getting back into the same problem again.
Mr. Hinkle of the ACLU very definitely thinks we would be.
Well, I have at the bottom of my notes, which I scribbled out while Bob Smith, Senator Smith, was talking to other people, equal protection problems. I wasn't going to go any further. That concludes my testimony. So, questions?
Is there a, can you analyze constitutional defensibility of the 6-month residency requirement? We just raise a separate issue.
For registration?
For a notary.
For a notary? No. I talked with John Leahy this morning, and frankly, that didn't come up.
Any questions? No, we're in the secondary today. And I think probably we ought to give Mr. Blumenauer the courtesy of comment on the other bill.
Thank you.
Particularly in a work session. Give us 2 minutes. Thank you. Some people have come in after we started. Was there anyone else who were here on the notary's public bill? Senate Bill 223. Mr. Hicks?
I'm Warren Hicks, State Court Administrator, appearing on behalf of the Supreme Court in support of Senate Bill 223, which was introduced into the legislature at the request of the Supreme Court. The purpose of the bill is to put into the statute clear language that a judge who is sued in his official capacity is entitled to be represented by an attorney at public expense if it is appropriate in a particular case. And the bill provides that these cases would be where there was no other means of a public attorney representing the judge. Ordinarily, if a judge is sued, he'd be represented by the Attorney General's office, or if it's a tort claim, he'd be represented by counsel under the Tort Claims Act and the insurance coverage the state of Oregon carries for all employees and officers. Occasionally, however, in the past several years, there have been cases of a judge being in the case ordinarily as a defendant, occasionally as a plaintiff, where a district attorney or a county or state official is on the other side, and therefore the attorney general is unable to represent the judge. In the other type of cases that this occurs in, that we've had a growing number of in the last few years, have been a mandamus action against the judge because of a ruling in a case. Our policy there has been that the attorney who was representing a client in whose favor the ruling was made would represent the judge as a part of the representation of a client. But on rare occasions, this is not appropriate, either because it was a person representing himself, and there is no attorney who could handle it, or an attorney in the case, but he didn't have expertise in this unusual problem. Maybe something of a public interest where the judge felt strongly that especially experienced counsel should be retained. And this is what the bill is trying to pinpoint. One, to put it in the statute so there's a clear public policy that the Supreme Court and the judges can follow in permitting private counsel to represent a judge at public expense. And
to give us a method that we, or a statute that we can point to that is the authority. The way it's been done in the past has been a line item in the circuit district court budget of a few thousand dollars for expense of judges who are sued in their official capacity. And there is a general statute that says state officers may be represented at public expense by the attorney general or by the district attorney at the local level. But every time we get one of these cases, both my office and the Supreme Court judges have felt uneasy because you just can't point to a statute where it shows what the policy should be. And therefore, we've introduced this bill. It has been reviewed by the Office of Attorney General, and Mick Gillette and I actually drew the bill. And Mr. Gillette appeared in the Senate for the Senate Judiciary and testified in favor of the bill in present form.
Mr. Lombard, does this situation arise most often in the mandamus type case? Is that usual when you get this kind of?
Yes, I think so. We get more of those, and as I said, most of them, the judge is represented by the attorney in the case, or occasionally, if the attorney doesn't want to represent the judge says, all right, then just let it go. He doesn't care which way the case is decided by, like the district judge, it'd be the circuit court, perhaps, or the appellate court. And I don't think a week goes by that some judge doesn't call me and say, I've been sued, what should I do? And ordinarily, it's a mandamus type. We did have one just the other day about a writ of review that we were just discussing here earlier. Judge Sands in Clackamas County was taken to circuit court because of a ruling made in district court. I don't know if it was on a subdivision case, but as you were discussing that earlier, Bill. But that's the first time I've heard of that one. Ordinarily, it's mandamus. I went through our list, which I have a list of them here, in fact. We paid private counsel over the last 5 or 6 years in from 1 to 6 cases a year. There have been many more where the attorney general has represented the judge or a private attorney in the case has represented the judge, but it runs around 3 or 4 or 5 a year when, for some reason, the Supreme Court approves the employment of a private counsel.
Lauren, I'm going
to ask you a question and going to show you. I don't know what all the statutes are. Would this apply to any disciplinary procedure by the Judicial Fitness Committee to...
I would say no. No. That would be an individual case against the judge. This is where he is sued because of the position he holds as a state official. And just like a suit against the governor isn't against Governor Straub, but personally, it'd be against the governor of the state of Oregon, who happens to be Governor Straub. Many of them actually end up being thrown out of court, not the mandamus types. We get many cases of disgruntled clients or citizens who, as you've heard, they sue all the judges of the Supreme Court and federal court and trial court. And the attorney general usually handles those, and they're out because of immunity and that sort of thing.
You probably know one of my constituents, Mr.
Yeah.
Robert Wright.
Very well. I was a judge in one of his famous cases.
He does.
One
right
of them.
Who's the judge?
Oh, yeah.
The provision of private counsel, am I correct in saying it would be contingent in all situations to a refusal by the Department of Justice to provide the defense?
That's where the judge would go first.
Yeah. In every case, he would be required to first address his request to the
When he first gets to, say, the mandamus, he has two choices. He can either ask the attorney in the case, which is ordinarily what he would do, to represent him. The case would be Smith versus Judge Jones, but there's an attorney in the case. If he doesn't want that attorney, or the attorney said, well, my client can't afford to represent this, might go to the Supreme Court, it's going to cost a lot of money, my attorney or my client can't afford it, then the judge can go to the attorney general. And then the attorney general would make the decision whether he would or would not defend, similar to the criteria that's in this bill. is there a public interest? Should the Attorney General step into this case, or should the Attorney General say no, you have an attorney in the case, the attorney should represent you? If the Attorney General says we can't represent the judge, then it would come to the Supreme Court, and he would be asking the Supreme Court for authority to employ a private attorney on the agreement that the Supreme Court would pay that attorney a reasonable fee upon completion of the case. I've got a list of these cases here, and we had 1 in 71, and 5 in 72, and 3 in 73, and 3 in 74, and 6 in 1976. And they were in some of them were juvenile cases. Just kind of a run of types of cases. One of the more unusual ones is where a judge was a plaintiff, was Judge Eunice, when he was presiding judge of the district court in Multnomah County, discharged an employee, and the employee took it to the, not sure what the title was, but the Multnomah County Civil Service Board, who said that the employee was a civil servant and the judge couldn't discharge him, and they had a lawsuit over whether or not he, court employees were civil servants. And because of the way the case came up, the Attorney General wouldn't represent the judge because the district attorney was representing the board, and the judge had to initiate a lawsuit, so he ended up as the plaintiff, and we did authorize private counsel in that case. Most of them have either been a citizen who's making trouble for a judge or a mandamus situation where the court felt that there was a reason to employ another private attorney. A time or two, they paid the attorney who was in the case because he was representing somebody who was indigent, and yet it wasn't appropriate for the county to pay the attorney, and so the court said this is a public interest case, and we will authorize you to hire the lawyer. And then when the case is over, the lawyer submits the bill, and it goes, if it's nominal, I approve it. If it's several hundred dollars or $1,000 or more, or I question whether it's a reasonable bill, and then I send it to court, and the judges discuss in the conference and make a formal order as to what amount the bill will be paid in.
Yeah. Is this process happening now without
statutory
authority?
Right. But all of us feel, I'd say nervous is the best word I can think of. We'd just rather see it in the statute, partly so then we would know we were doing it on an authority that the legislature had examined and written into the statute. Also, it gives us something to point to when we get these numerous questions about what is supposed to happen in a situation like this. We can say, well, look up ORS such and such, and it would settle it. Whereas now, it's a lot of letters back and forth and telephoning and trying to explain it. It just seems to us it should be in the statute. This also was passed through a committee of the Judicial Conference, committee of judges, and they initially authorized and recommended legislation, and it went before the Supreme Court as well, and those judges decided that it should be in the form of a bill.
Further questions? Bronco? Oh, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to ask, where did you get your money to pay the people now?
There's a line item in the district court and the circuit court judge's budget. I think it was put in, as far as I can tell, the first time about either 69 or 67. And there's been $3,000 or $5,000, and last time we had $6,000 for the biennium. And it's just in a line item along with the judge's salaries and travel expense. There was an attorney general's opinion in 1967, I think, in a case that said that the state should pay. Judge Crookham was involved in a lawsuit, and the question was to the attorney general, should the county pay his expenses or should the state pay the expenses? And the attorney general's opinion was that the state should pay the expenses because he was a state officer. And we've always pointed that opinion as the authority we were using. I think maybe that opinion was what resulted in the money being in the budget, although I've never been able to trace that exactly. Just isn't documented. That's another reason we think it ought to be in the statute. Well, it's just kind of grown up.
I've got a question on the bill, lines 15 through 20. We've got two contingencies there. First, that the state would pay under this bill if there is no party who should bear the cost, and then two, or if there is no party who will bear the cost. And the way I read it, if you have a party who should but who won't, then the state has to pay. So why do you need paragraph 1 if you have paragraph 2? And let's say you amended paragraph 2 to read, conclude that there is no party interested, that there is no party who is interested in the outcome, who will provide. Seems like 1 and 2 are a little bit, not vague, but they go over the same ground.
Well, the distinction we're trying to get at was that in some cases there is no attorney in the case, particularly somebody suing on his own. And yet it is an illegal situation. The judge ought to be represented, and there should be some litigation about this case. The second one is where there is an attorney, but the trial judge and the Supreme Court agree that that particular attorney, for one reason or another, isn't the attorney that ought to handle this case. And we had one example of that where the attorney in the case was, he and the judge didn't get along at all, and the judge did not want that attorney. Another one we had was where Judge Blanding in Clackamas County had a juvenile court question, and he wanted an attorney who was particularly skilled in this facet of law. And,
okay, I'll go along with that. But,
so that's why there's two.
If you have,
it could be expressed in one paragraph, perhaps, but
yeah,
that's really good.
I would think that you could go with two, maybe change the wording a little bit, but under one, if you have a party who should bear the cost, but who for some reason or other doesn't, you're stuck, and the state has to pay anyway.
Well, of course, some of this, this doesn't say that will happen. These are the guidelines the Supreme Court. Supreme Court would decide if any of these three situations exist. And they could say, the way we intended at least in this bill, that one of these three occurs, it would be a reasonable request to court. But the court would still decide whether or not the situation was such that an attorney should be employed.
Are the two paragraphs I'm referring to part of the original bill or part of the bill?
Those were amendments drafted by Mr. Gillette, and I felt he actually improved the original draft.
For the question?
He felt fairly strongly about wanting to insert this language, and that is his language.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Robertson.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Robertson. I'm an attorney in Salem. I'm appearing on behalf of myself personally and also on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyer Association. And I have with me today Mr. Pete Peterson, who is an attorney in Woodburn. The reason why I've asked to appear before the committee today is expressed my opposition and the Trial Lawyers Association's opposition to this bill. As I'm confident the members of the city know, at one time Oregon did have this type of immunity for charitable organizations, and that was abolished by the Supreme Court by case law. And in the case abolishing it, it adopted a dissenting opinion by Justice Brandt in an earlier case discussing the same issue. And they expressly adopted Justice Brandt's dissenting opinion. In reviewing that this morning before I came up, his opinion was able to throw some light, at least for me, on how the charitable immunity doctrine got started and why it was abolished and why it has been abolished in the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions. Justice Brandt, in that article, was pointing out that in the old days, charitable organizations were considerably different than they are today. At one time, primarily, I guess, the way they were operated, they were funded by a benevolent donor that gave them a lump sum of money and they did whatever they so pleased. But as he pointed out, and pointed out, he chronicled many of the courts of other jurisdictions, by pointing out that charitable organizations today aren't like they were perhaps 100 or 200 years ago, but in fact they're businesses. And one court even turned it as nothing charitable, but more accurately termed as non-profit organization, as opposed to charitable organization. Today we have charitable organizations that are not supported by this individual donor, but they're supported by large community fund drives. They pay salaries to their employees, as other businesses do, and of course they have volunteers, but the staff employees are salaried, and they pay all their compensation. In addition, most charitable organizations, especially with regard to hospitals, they charge for the services. At least they charge what the traffic will bear. And oftentimes, as we all know, even a charitable organization that's not like a hospital is more than willing to accept donations from people who receive the services. In addition, the government has granted charitable organizations tax benefits, and so it has helped them carry on their purposes by granting them the tax benefits. That's one of the most important things, is that almost all of the charitable organizations now are carrying liability insurance. And for those that don't carry liability insurance, they have large enough assets that they're self-insured. And whenever you're able to carry liability insurance or be a self-service operation, the need to protect the assets isn't what it used to be 200 years ago. Another aspect about the charitable organizations that presently exist today that didn't exist before is that they seem to compete with each other. Now, this bill is very, very broad, and it defines a charitable agency to include any association organized and operated exclusively for a charitable, a religious, educational, or scientific purpose. Now, that would include private schools, for example, such as Willamette or any other private school, and we know that they compete substantially with other schools for their students. They maintain a large salary, and they do have the tax benefit. In addition, this is very scary as far as I'm concerned, it would eliminate liability for an association operated for a scientific purpose. Now, the this goes on further to say that
kind of cogent being
used. I was thinking, right when I read this, I was thinking if the ketone was manufactured by one of these organizations and they polluted the James River and exposed all the people in Richmond, Virginia to all this, they escaped liability completely. And that's, you know, that's with regard to scientific and educational, I guess, do the same thing, and charitable and religious organizations wouldn't have anything as scary as that, hopefully. But another argument with regard to the scientific purpose, I'm not a tax lawyer, and believe me, I'll tell you, I'm the first one to know nothing about it. But I think of, like, these pharmaceutical companies. What would stop them from funding their research, experimental research, through a grant to setting up a charitable organization, let them do the testing, what have you, and then any liabilities that accrue from that say, well, sorry, that's not us. That's this charitable organization that's set up over here by itself. And, of course, if they would be able to reap the benefits from it. I don't know whether that could be worked out, but it appears that there might be a possibility. The bill itself, I think, is unwieldy. In Section 1, subsection 2, it says, in order for one of these charitable agencies to qualify, they must they have a written disclosure to the agency in the manner provided by the agency of an individual's educational background, skills, work experience, and other training that allow the agency to assign duties to the individual appropriate to its qualifications. So we have some agency out here that these people have to register with, and they have to say, well, this person is going to perform X, Y, Z duties, and the reason why they can do it is because they have ABC qualifications. One of the major criticisms of the charitable immunity as it existed before was that because of its inherent unfairness, there were all these little exemptions put in, and, well, charitable immunity applied here, but not in this case, and not in this case, not in this case. And it applied in tort actions, but not in a sumptuous. So if you could frame your cause of action in a sumptuous, you could get in. And you're going to have the same type of finagling with here. If you're down to Section 3, in order to obtain this limitation liability, the agency shall assign duties to volunteers involving only regular clients and recognized services of the agency. And I think you can see the questions for liability there. What's a recognized service of the agency? What's a regular client? Second, they can assign duties to volunteers that are commensurate with the volunteer's qualifications as indicated on the registration statement. I think you can see the Pandora's box there opening up what the qualifications are. Perhaps an area that also shows its problems is as it would relate to a hospital. For example, recently here in Salem, a person was made quadriplegic by the Salem Memorial Hospital. Liability was clear. They received a verdict. The person was in, I believe, in his 30s. He was the breadwinner for the family. He was sole means of support. And he's a quadriplegic for the rest of his life. Now, if that would happen under this bill at Salem Memorial Hospital, which I believe is owned by a foreign corporation, he could recover. But if they went to a hospital that was owned by a religion or a charity, but the same person could not recover. I think the gross unfairness is evident. Perhaps the most interesting aspect I found in Judge Brand's dissenting opinion, as I point out was later adopted by the Supreme Court, is that what is public policy? Is the public policy here to protect the charitable organizations, or is it for something else? And he pointed out, I thought quite persuasively, that the public policy has been defined, and I'll quote briefly from it, by the Constitution. He says, every man shall have the remedy by due course of law for injury done him in his person, property, or reputation. Thus it would appear that the public policy of this state, as enunciated by the Constitution, is to put justice by due course of law above charity. It is a trite saying that charity begins at home. It may reasonably be said that charitable institutions must first fairly compensate those who are injured and damaged by the negligence of their officers and their servants and the conduct of the affairs of such institutions before going farther afield to dispense charity and do good. Then he goes on and he discusses the need to keep charitable operations available, and he points out that by imposing liability on them, it's not going to deter their actions, but he believes that in the end result, if they are answerable to their actions, as we all are, that there'll be a more efficient operation. And I think perhaps his statements have proved to be true, because we've had no immunity for charitable organizations, and they aren't diminishing, they're increasing. Their assets aren't diminishing, they have considerable assets. And if, for example, a person was injured, especially a breadwinner was injured by someone who was severely injured by a charity, that he made wards of the state. Somebody else he's paying for it. Now, this bill was introduced at the request of Salem Volunteer Bureau. And although we don't know, we think the timing has something to do with a recent case here in Salem involving the Salvation Army, where a 12-year-old girl was killed. The reason why Mr. Peterson's here today is that he's representing a 12-year-old girl, and I thought he could explain to you something about that case to show the claimant side of the matter.
Mr. Chairman, is that appropriate in a legislative body to talk to
him? I don't know if it's appropriate, but I don't think it's necessary.
All right.
I think the bill is going to be summarily... Not summarily, of course he will go through certain and I don't mean to be speaking to other members of the committee. I just sense perhaps there's a certain opposition. Representative Darnia.
I was just saying, Chief Justice Swabs, to me, the first time that I argued an appeal before the Court of Appeals, I went on and on and said, you
convince
us, Mr. Gardner, don't
undo
yourself.
That's right.
Since I came down, I'd like to at least concur with his argument.
I don't mean to cut you off necessarily, and I'm not sure if Representative Frommeyer points out or not, but
I was just going to
satisfaction, you join probably a winning effort here.
Yeah, I was going to argue some of the practicalities of it, but it's obvious.
Yeah. I think that if the bill emerges, other than a tabling recommendation, we might let you know, or if you want to stay around for a few minutes, we'll take action on the subcommittee recommendation probably in the next 5 minutes. Representative Frommeyer?
I had just a couple of questions. They're kind of open-ended because I don't know the answer to them. I'm certainly opposed to the bill the way it's written here, and I don't know that it could be resuscitated in any form that would make it acceptable, but I think I take issue with your view that most of these small charities or organizations are either self-insured or have liability insurance. In my experience, that some of the smaller volunteer groups don't have either. And as a matter of fact, their volunteers have oftentimes very serious questions about what they can do within the scope of their work for the charity that will be covered by somebody's insurance, either their homeowner's insurance for off-premises accidents or if the charity is big enough to have its own. And at the same time, charities or educational institutions or both are unsure about the role of volunteer. And there's a seems to me is a real need to clarify the limits of the law here, and perhaps not to sock the charities unfairly with actions that are only tangentially related to that of the charity. And while I'm not satisfied with this bill, I think there's more of a problem than perhaps you recognize.
You may have comment just past the matter. First of all, I don't doubt your experience. I'm sure it's just accurate that there are these charitable organizations who don't carry the liability insurance. I think I have two comments. One is a public policy matter. As Justice Brandt said, shouldn't charity begin at home? And as perhaps the top dollar going out to charity, they should carry the liability insurance. Second matter is a practical matter. We all know that when somebody does a person, you normally don't go after them. And they try to recover because you're just wasting your time and resources. And it's just one of the sad things in life that some people are judgment-proof. And in those cases, I think if a claim is injured and the charity has no assets and the volunteer has no assets, there's not going to be any attempt to recover.
Mr. Lombard, just out of curiosity, what is that case that you're alluding to?
Which case?
Citation
is Justice Brandt's decision. That case is... It's Landgraver, Landgraver, versus Emmanuel Lutheran. The citation is 203 Oregon, 489. Then the majority opinion there upheld the charitable immunity doctrine. That was 1955 case. And subsequent to that, in Hungerford, H-U-N-G-E-R-F-O-R-D, versus Portland Sanitarium, that appears at 235 Oregon, 412. The charitable immunity doctrine was abolished in Oregon, and the majority expressly incorporated, as I read the case, Justice Brandt's dissenting opinion on the case I just cited.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Representative
Dugas. Yes, sir.
Since the sponsor of the bill is here, and I noticed the unusual feature commenting about how it was introduced, do you know anything about the genesis? Who's Kathy Hanson in the Salem Volunteer Bureau, and what's the background? Do you have any idea?
No, I have nothing.
Just being a Salem attorney, I thought I'd
wonder. I have nothing other than
Salem Volunteer Bureau is a pseudonym for Fleischner, who's about to testify.
Thank you.
Also known as the Oregon Hospital Association.
Thank you.
I feel as though I'm one approaching the toilet and it's just been flushed. I'm Pete Fleischman. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals. I'd like to indicate that Representative Kulongoski suggested that coming forth to support this bill was like a chicken walking into the fox's den, and I think his assessment was very accurate. I don't know Kathy Hanson, nor do I know anything about the Salem Volunteer Bureau. It's my best guess, however, that it was not her intent to reinstate the old charitable immunity doctrine for hospitals, although the effect of this bill would do just exactly that, and I would be less than diligent in my job if I weren't here to support it. Notwithstanding the summary dismissal is likely to come. I think there is one thing about this bill that has some real merit that hasn't been said, and that is protection to the person, the volunteer. Notwithstanding the agency, in my case, the hospital, but it seems to me that the volunteer might be given some consideration. There are thousands, literally thousands, of volunteers in Oregon hospitals. Not only the charitable, so-called charitable tax-exempt hospitals, and Salem Hospital is one of them, incidentally, but also the government political subdivision hospitals, and even the proprietary or tax-paying hospitals have volunteers. And these people, I think, sometimes do feel that they're being jeopardized in working in a situation that is at least ostensibly fraught with malpractice or liability problems. So you might give some serious consideration to that element if you can't bring yourself to seriously consider the plight of hospitals in this situation. I would assume that line 24, assigned duties to volunteers involving only regular clients, I assume that a patient would be a regular client in a hospital. This obviously was not written for hospitals.
What was it written for?
I don't have anything further. I'll try to respond to questions.
Everything is from there.
For the typical pink lady or the checker girl or whatever they are that works in the hospital in the association, are they covered by the hospital's blanket liability policy in case they do something wrong?
Yeah, the answer is yes, mostly. Most hospital policies cover employees and volunteers. There are some hospital policies that do not. And my guess is that the government tort liability might pick up those, at least the limitations.
I'm referring to the nonprofit hospital where you have the candy factory.
Yeah, I would say that most of them do cover them. I don't think that makes the people feel any better, but it covers the institution for acts of the volunteer.
It doesn't cover the individual.
No. If there's a judgment against the individual, the judgment won't be paid by the insurance company, but the individual will be defended because that person would have to be defended in order to defend the hospital. That's not true with employees. Most
but
employees are covered.
But what you're saying is there could be joint several liability then with the candy striper and the hospital and the doctor and only one part of that judgment would be, and theoretically then the insurance company would have indemnity over or contribution rights over against the candy striper and pink lady.
Yes.
I have one comment to go along with what the witness has testified to. The Interim Committee on Judiciary Subcommittee on Corrections and the Governor's Task Force on Corrections at various time periods pleads for some sort of legislation which would protect individuals who volunteer to work with criminal defendants, sentenced offenders in a community corrections setting, as people who want to try to rehabilitate criminal defendants by working with them one way or another, and yet they don't know whether there'd be some exposure, some liability in case the defendant or any other person were hurt. They want to get involved and want to try to help rehabilitation, but they just don't dare until they find out whether they're protected.
Further questions?
Thank you. Thank you, I think I'll leave.
It's with my courage.
Well, let's, the motion on, the bill was that? 2484. Mr. Gardner?
I move that the subcommittee recommend the full committee, the House of 2484.
Representative Gardner recommends, or moves that subcommittee recommend tabling of 2484 to the full committee. Any discussion? Any objection to that recommendation? Okay. And let's go back in order. 2372. I think we've got some other bills on this to review, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, I guess this could stand by itself. It doesn't relate to the actual operation of the procedure. Is there a motion on 2372? Representative Kielgowski?
Reports recommendation to the full committee.
Discussion? Objection? Stop. 2406.
I'm willing to make a motion unless you want to wait and hear from Earl.
He can always bring it up at the work session.
Yeah, we'll hear him then. Is there a motion on it? Motion is to recommend tabling. Discussion? Objection? 2509. Senator Gardner?
Move that the subcommittee recommend the full committee that House Bill 2509 be passed.
Here with an amendment?
Yeah, you got your
emergency clause.
Did you want to put it on?
That
is the emergency clause in your motion?
Yeah.
Discussion? Objection? Adopted. 223. What about 223?
Would like that.
Review the recommendation be passed. Discussion.
objection?
I was wondering, discussion for a minute, Mr. Chairman. Comment he made about funding. It appears that they've taken care of funding for this in previous budgets that have to do with the circuit court. I wonder if we'd ought to include maybe a comment to raise will it go to anything? There's a fiscal impact of $10,000 or $19,000.
Does this have a substitute for?
I would look that up. I don't know.
I got the impression that Lauren was saying that the bill merely puts into
effect
what they're already doing
in
practice,
yeah,
and they're already
cool.
Budgeting for it.
Well, I thought I just raised the question. I wasn't sure.
Further discussion on the motion? Objection? Further business? Adjourn to 1:30 tomorrow.